This summer, I had to stay long-term at an Airbnb while my house was getting renovated. Even though it was a little more expensive than I'd hoped, I ended up staying at a pretty nice condo outside the city. It was part of a gated community with a pool and an exercise room. There were some long-term residents, but most of the people in the community were Airbnb renters like me. After I settled in and unpacked all my stuff, I met my next-door neighbors, a young couple named James and Pamela. They seemed nice enough, but I wasn't really in the mood to make friends while I was there. We talked for a bit, and then I went back inside. That night, I was having trouble sleeping. I'm used to having a very firm mattress in my house, but my new bed was almost laughably soft. I'd fall asleep for a few minutes, and then wake up from pain in my lower back. It was around midnight when I noticed a movement through my window. I could see James and Pamela's house next door with their bedroom window directly facing mine. They had their blinds open, and I could see them standing in the room, arguing with each other. I knew I shouldn't look, but I had nothing else to do. Besides, they couldn't see me anyway. I watched as the couple got angrier and angrier at each other. Eventually, Pamela shoved James, and James shoved her back. I jumped out of my bed and ran to the window to get a better view. If things turned violent next door, I needed to be ready to call 911. Things very quickly turned violent. I saw James knock Pamela onto the ground. Then nothing happened for a long time. And then Pamela jumped back into view. She was holding a lamp against her chest. James said something to her, and she surged forward and swung the lamp against his head. He immediately collapsed onto the ground. After that, I couldn't see James through the window, but I saw Pamela slam the lamp, and I saw a splash of blood splatter against the window. I was too stunned to move. I know I should have hidden and called the police, but I'd never seen someone get murdered before. Then Pamela stood straight up, dropped the now broken lamp onto the ground, and turned right toward me. She knew I'd seen everything. She smiled at me. Finally overcoming my shock, I grabbed my phone from the nightstand and called 911. In less than 5 minutes, a police car pulled up to my house, and I ran outside to greet them. Two cops came out, and I told them everything in a single breath. The first cop wrote everything down, while the other glanced toward the house next door. I wasn't scared anymore. I knew that they'd find the body, take Pamela away, and everything would go back to normal. Unfortunately, that's not what happened. Right after I finished my explanation, the front door opened, and James stepped out. He was alive! He wiped the sleep out of his eyes and walked up to the cops as if nothing had happened.
What's going on?
Pamela joined them too. She apologized to the officers for wasting their time and explained that I must have had a bad dream or something. The cops were not happy. They told me that fake 911 calls were illegal and that I was lucky that they weren't going to arrest me. Then they got back in their car and left. Once the three of us were alone, Pamela started laughing.
Works every time.
She explained that she and her husband like to play jokes on their neighbors. They travel to new places and orchestrate morbid pranks, like fake murders, to see how people react. To prove her point, James pulled out a half-empty packet of fake blood that they'd used. Unlike his wife, though, James wasn't laughing. He seemed almost embarrassed by their prank.
No hard feelings, right? Pamela asked.
Annoyed and a little confused, I walked back inside without saying anything. Over the next few hours, I stopped thinking about my strange neighbors and tried to go back to sleep. It took a while, but I was finally able to doze off. I would have slept for the rest of the night, but a creaking noise woke me back up. I opened my eyes to see James opening my bedroom window and climbing inside. I knew this was another stupid prank, so I decided to confront him directly. What the hell are you doing? James explained that he was running away. He was done playing pranks with his wife. It was fun at first, but she'd taken things too far. He asked if I could help him, if he could hide out until the morning and then leave before Pamela found him. No, I answered. Good for you for changing your mind, but I'm staying out of it. He nodded sadly, and then started climbing back out through the same window. Suddenly, we heard noises coming from the other house. Pamela was awake. James dropped back into my bedroom and hid under the windowsill. Pamela turned on the light next door and looked into my window.
Hey! She shouted. Have you seen my husband?
Please, James whispered from the floor. I almost ratted him out, but instead, I lied and said he wasn't there. She looked at me for a long moment, trying to figure out if she could trust me.
Okay, but tell me if you do. Please.
Then she gave up and walked back into her house. Can't you just talk to your wife? I asked.
No,
he answered sadly.
She always plays these morbid jokes where I get murdered, and it's all fun and games. But she told me that if I ever leave her, she'll kill me for real.
Even though his expression seemed genuine, this still felt like another trick. I thought about kicking him out, but I decided not to. As long as he was gone in the morning, everything would be fine. Besides, if he tried to do anything, I'd wake up and stop him. Fine, I told him. Lying on my carpet without any blanket or pillow, he closed his eyes and fell asleep. I leaned back on my pillow and improbably fell asleep. Nothing woke me up for the rest of the night. Eventually, I woke up to a loud banging sound. It was already morning and sunlight shined through the windows. I saw James's feet sticking out from the side of my bed, so I knew he was still asleep on my floor. The sound must have been someone else. Groggily, I got out of bed and stumbled toward the front door where the sound had come from. Just as I reached it, the door burst open and a policeman ran inside, his gun aimed at me.
Put your hands in the air!
I raised my arms, confused.
Get down on the ground, now!
The officer ordered. He was the same one from last night. I did what he said. While I was lying on the ground, the policeman charged in and went straight to my bedroom. I didn't move. From the other room, I could hear him calling in for backup. I stood up and walked toward the bedroom, my arms still raised. I looked into the room and saw the policeman crouched on the floor next to James. Poor James had a knife sticking out of his face. It wasn't a joke, he was definitely dead. His wife had killed him while I slept. It's a miracle she didn't wake me up. The policeman turned toward me.
You thought you'd cover your tracks by reporting a fake murder yesterday, didn't you? You knew you were going to kill this man, didn't you?
I had no idea what to say. Through the window, I could see Pamela waiting outside with another officer. He held her as she cried.
I didn't kill anyone,
I screamed. The policeman grabbed me and placed me in handcuffs. He read me my rights and took me away. As he guided me through the front door and into the police car, I could see Pamela watching us. She was still pretending to cry, but she stopped for a second to wink at me.
It was her! I screamed. She killed him!
The cop didn't believe me. He shoved me into the back seat.
Wait!
Pamela screamed. Then she walked over and told the cop that she wanted to see her husband's killer face to face. The cop stepped away, and she leaned against the car window.
I'm sorry,
she whispered to me.
This has nothing to do with you.
Then she wordlessly walked back to the two policemen and told them to take me away. I'm on bail now, awaiting trial. Everyone thinks I'm guilty. Pamela planted enough evidence against me to put me away for a long time. When my trial comes, I'll finally be able to tell my side of the story. I pray that someone will believe me.
The first time we saw the house, it felt perfect. Quaint, nestled on the edge of town, with a wraparound porch and an old oak tree that made me think of lazy afternoons and lemonade. Mike loved it instantly too. We'd been looking for months, but this felt right. There was just one strange thing. Before we signed the papers, the realtor, a stern older woman with cold eyes, told us about the door in the basement. I remember the way her voice dropped when she said it.
Never open the door on Halloween night.
I laughed at first. I mean, it sounded like something out of a bad horror movie. But she was dead serious. Mike gave her a look like she was crazy. But we didn't think much of it. It was just a locked door. Probably a gimmick. Who cared, right? Halloween night came faster than we had expected. We'd thrown a small party with some friends. Music was playing, drinks were flowing, and everyone was having a great time. It was perfect. It was just what we needed after the stress of the move. At some point, someone asked about the door. I don't even remember who brought it up, but the mood shifted when they did. The drinks made me braver, and maybe just dumber, but I was curious. I'd been curious about it since the day we moved in. We'd tried the handle when we first toured the house, but it had been locked tight. After the realtor's warning, we'd let it go. Until tonight. The others egged us on, laughing, teasing. Mike shook his head. It's just an old door, he said. Probably leads to a storage room or something. Come on, I said, feeling bold with a glass of wine in my hand. It's Halloween. What's the worst that could happen? He sighed, but I could see it in his eyes. He was curious too. A part of him wanted to see what was behind that door just as much as I did. So, we all stumbled down into the basement, laughing and joking like idiots. The door was heavy, made of dark wood, worn and ancient. Mike found some old tools in the garage and, with a little force, managed to pry it open. When it creaked open, there was a moment of silence. The air was cold, colder than the rest of the basement, and there was a smell, musty, like something old and forgotten. The room beyond was pitch black. I felt a strange pool, a kind of dizziness, but I brushed it off as the alcohol. Weird, someone said, breaking the silence. We laughed, but it was nervous laughter. Something felt off. We should have shut the door right then, but we didn't. We left it open. Later that night, after everyone had left and the house was quiet, I started to feel strange. Mike was already asleep in bed, but I couldn't shake the feeling that something was wrong. I felt like I was being watched. My skin prickled as I lay next to him. Every sound in the house seemed amplified, like something was moving just beyond my line of sight. I tried to ignore it, to brush it off as leftover anxiety from the party. But then it hit me. The smell. That musty, rotting smell from the basement. It was in our room now, heavy in the air. I sat up, my heart racing, and looked around. That's when I saw him. A man stood in the corner of the room, half shrouded in shadow. His eyes were dark, hollow. He wasn't Mike. He was someone else. Someone I didn't know. My breath caught in my throat. I wanted to scream, to wake Mike, but I couldn't move. I couldn't speak. And then, he smiled. Everything that happened next was a blur, like I was trapped inside my own body, helpless as it moved without me. His hands touched me and I didn't stop him. I couldn't stop him. My skin burned under his touch, but I wasn't in control. It felt like someone else was pulling the strings, making me move, making me want him. I don't know how long it lasted. I remember flashes of him, his lips, the weight of his body against mine. And all I could do was watch from somewhere deep inside myself, unable to scream, unable to make it stop. I woke up the next morning with a splitting headache, the kind that digs into your skull and lingers. Mike wasn't beside me. The sheets were cold. My heart pounded as I remembered bits of the night before. The man, his touch, my betrayal. No, it couldn't be real. It had to be some kind of nightmare, hallucination from drinks and exhaustion. But deep down, I knew it wasn't. It had happened. I pulled myself out of bed, nausea swirling in my stomach, and wandered through the house looking for Mike. I found him in the kitchen. He was sitting at the table staring down at a crumpled piece of paper. He didn't look up when I came in.
Mike?
My voice cracked. Something was wrong. I could feel it. Without a word, he slid the note across the table towards me. His face was pale, his eyes hollow and distant. My stomach dropped as I read the words.
I know what you did. I saw everything.
The room spun around me. My hands trembled. He knew. He had seen me with the man. But that couldn't be right. He was asleep, wasn't he? He hadn't been there. But the look in his eyes told me everything.
I didn't mean to, Mike. I whispered, my voice shaking. I wasn't myself. I don't know what happened. I would never.
Stop, he said quietly. His voice was so cold, so dead. I don't want to hear it.
I reached out to get close to him, to explain, to beg him to understand that it hadn't been me. But he flinched away, pushing the chair back with a screech. His eyes were red, filled with tears he wouldn't let fall. And then, without another word, he stood up and left the room. The front door slammed shut behind him. I didn't see him for hours after that. I thought maybe he'd just gone for a drive to clear his head, to get away from me. I spent the day in a fog, barely able to breathe, replaying everything in my mind over and over. How could I have let that happen? How had I been so weak? I checked my phone obsessively, waiting for a text or call from Mike, but there was nothing. It wasn't until later, when the sun had started to set, that I realized something was really wrong. I searched the house, panic setting in, calling his name, but there was no answer. Finally, I found him. The bathroom door was locked. I pounded on it, screaming his name, begging him to open it. Silence. I don't remember how I broke it down, but when I did, I saw him. Mike was lying in the tub, his wrists open and bleeding into the water. His face was pale, his eyes closed, peaceful. He was gone. I screamed, but it felt distant. The sound was coming from someone else. It's been days now. I can't remember the last time I slept. Every time I close my eyes, I see him. Mike. And the man. The one who wasn't really a man at all. I know now. I know what we did. We opened that door and whatever was behind it was still here. Inside me, if you know what I mean. It used me that night, made me do things I can't even comprehend. And now, Mike is gone because of me. Because we broke the rule. My roommate Jed and I were supposed to go to a costume party last Halloween in some house near campus. Jed was going to be Tarzan because he just lost a bunch of weight and wanted to show off. I was going to be a ninja, the same costume I'd worn the last 3 years. I was all set to go when Jed casually mentioned that my ex Tristan would be there. I did not want to be anywhere near that psycho, so I told him I wouldn't go. He went without me. He ended up switching into my ninja costume at the last minute because he was feeling self-conscious about showing so much in his Tarzan suit. Before he left, he told me he wouldn't stay too long at the party. He didn't like Tristan either. He'd rather spend Halloween with me. So he said he would come back early and we'd go to a club instead. He still wanted to make an appearance at the party though. I waited 3 hours, but he didn't come back. I texted to ask if he changed his mind, but he didn't respond. I stayed up all night worrying about him. I hoped he'd found some girl and just forgot to text me, but deep down, I felt that something had happened to him. The next morning, he still hadn't answered any of my texts, so I decided to go to the house where the party had been. It was a nice house in a nice neighborhood, though the front yard was covered in empty cups and beer cans. I knocked on the front door, and guess who answered? Tristan. She was visibly hungover. I hated seeing her again. I vowed to myself right after our breakup that I'd avoid Tristan at all costs, and now I was breaking that rule. My roommate was missing, and I was desperate. I had to talk to her. Before I could ask my first question, Tristan already knew what I was going to say.
Jed never showed up last night. I assume that's why you're here.
Are you sure? I asked.
We had a couple dozen people here, she explained. But no ninjas. Sorry.
She started to close the door in my face, but I stopped it with my foot. I asked her how she knew what costume Jed was wearing. He hadn't decided to borrow my costume until right before the party, but she couldn't have known that. Tristan mumbled out some excuse, but I didn't pay attention. As she was talking, I pulled out my phone and dialed Jed's number. Immediately, his phone started to ring somewhere inside the house. She instantly stopped talking. She knew she'd been caught in a lie.
Damn it!
She shouted, then pulled me inside and slammed the door behind me. She wasn't the only one in the house. Her new boyfriend was there too. He was huge, 6'2" and at least 300 pounds. As Tristan took my phone out of my hands, this man grabbed me by the shirt and pulled me across the room. I struggled to break free, but he was too strong. He opened the door to the basement and threw me down the stairs. Then he slammed the door shut behind me, leaving me in total darkness. I fumbled against the walls until I found the light switch. When I turned it on, I saw Jed lying dead on the ground. He was still in his ninja costume. I could hear voices through the door. Tristan and her boyfriend were discussing what to do with me. From what I could hear, I pieced together what had happened the night before. Tristan and her boyfriend had planned to murder me at the party. And they'd succeeded. The only problem was that Jed was wearing my costume, so they'd murdered the wrong person. Now that they had me trapped, they'd finally be able to finish the job. I looked all around the basement for a way to escape. There was only one window big enough for me to crawl through, but it was painted shut. The basement was completely empty, so I didn't have anything to break the window. Then I looked at poor dead Jed. His costume included ninja stars hanging from the belt. They were real metal and pretty sharp. I took one and broke the window just as Tristan's boyfriend was walking down the stairs. Acting fast, I climbed through the broken glass. I was halfway out of the window when the man grabbed my feet and pulled me back inside. Shards of glass cut across my stomach. I fell back onto the basement floor. The man stood over me, looking absolutely massive. He didn't need any weapons to kill me. He grabbed my throat and squeezed. I couldn't breathe. Behind my attacker, Tristan had entered the basement. She was just there to watch. And as her boyfriend strangled me, she broke out in a huge grin. Thankfully, I still had the ninja star in my hand. I gripped it tight, the sharp edges cutting into my palm. Then I waved my arm forward and slashed him across the chest. I only cut him a little, but it was enough to make him lose his grip on my neck. As he stumbled backwards, I went back to the broken window and climbed out. Tristan screamed at me as I climbed onto the front yard and raced to my car. I drove a safe distance away and called the cops. By the time they arrived, Tristan and her boyfriend were gone. They'd left Jed's body behind. The doctors had to stitch up the cuts along my stomach, but other than that, I was okay. The same couldn't be said for Jed, though. I still feel guilty that my friend had been killed in my place, but I'm mostly scared that one day, Tristan and her boyfriend will come back for me. Who would have thought bad breath could kill a man? I mused this grimly, staring at the antiseptic glare of my bathroom mirror. Years of dental hygiene rituals, brushing, flossing, tongue scraping, all had been in vain. The sour odor persisted like a dark shadow, haunting my interactions, poisoning my confidence. My now ex-girlfriend had been the latest to confirm my suspicions, sending me spiraling into a desperate quest for answers. Her words still stung, but they spurred me into action. I had always been meticulous about my oral hygiene. I saw my dentist religiously, brushed 3 times a day, flossed after every meal, and scrubbed my tongue till it bled. Yet, the persistent white coating on my tongue never disappeared. My dentist had been baffled, offering no solution beyond more rigorous cleaning. It wasn't until I stumbled upon an obscure medical article online that I found a possible explanation. Oral candiditis, a fungal infection that could cause chronic bad breath. Armed with this knowledge, I made an appointment with my doctor.
Dr. Stevenson confirmed my self-diagnosis with a casual ease that made me question my years of suffering. "A week on these antifungal meds and you'll be as good as new," he said, scribbling on his prescription pad. His nonchalance infuriated me. How could something so debilitating be so easily dismissed? As I left the doctor's office, a sense of relief mingled with a simmering anger. Years of social anxiety, failed relationships, and shattered self-esteem, all because of a simple fungal infection. I started the medication that evening, vowing to reclaim my life. The next few days were surreal. The white coating on my tongue began to fade, and the rancid taste in my mouth dulled. For the first time in years, I felt hopeful. But it wasn't just my breath that changed. Strange things started happening around me. I woke up one night to a whispering sound. At first, I thought it was my imagination, the remnants of a dream. But then I heard it again, a soft, unintelligible murmur emanating from the bathroom. I crept out of the bed and pushed open the door. The mirror was fogged up, and written in the condensation were the words, "Help me." I blinked, convinced I was still dreaming. I wiped the mirror clean and went back to bed, dismissing the incident as a figment of my exhausted mind. But the whispers continued over the next few nights, always coming from the bathroom, always at the same time. Unable to ignore it any longer, I set up a voice recorder before going to bed. The next morning, I played back the tape. Amidst the ambient noise, I heard it clearly, a faint, desperate voice whispering, "Help me." I felt a chill run down my spine. Someone or something was in my apartment. I considered calling the police, but what would I tell them? That my bathroom mirror was haunted? I needed proof. That night, I set up a video camera. I didn't sleep, keeping one eye on the bathroom door. Around 3 a.m., the whispering started. I tiptoed to the bathroom, heart pounding, and flung open the door. The mirror was fogged up again, the words "help me" scrawled across it. But this time, there was something else. A face, faintly reflected in the glass, staring back at me. I stumbled back, tripping over the rug. The face was gone, but the message remained. I grabbed my phone and took a picture, my hand shaking. I needed to know what was happening. I spent the next day researching hauntings, trying to find a logical explanation. Everything pointed to a classic case of a restless spirit, but I wasn't ready to accept that. I decided to investigate the history of my apartment. At the local library, I uncovered a series of articles about a man named Henry Thompson, who had lived in my apartment a decade ago. He was a recluse, rarely seen by neighbors. One day, a foul odor led the building superintendent to Henry's apartment, where he was found dead. The cause of death was ruled a suicide, but rumor suggested foul play. I returned home, determined to communicate with Henry. I set up my camera and sat in front of the mirror, speaking softly. "Henry, if you're here, I want to help you. What happened to you?" The whispers started again, more urgent this time. The mirror fogged up and a new message appeared. "Find the key." I searched the apartment, tearing through drawers and closets. In a dusty corner of the bedroom, I found a loose floorboard. Beneath it was a small, rusty key. I had no idea what it unlocked, but I was getting closer. That night, I set the key on the bathroom sink. "Henry, I found the key. What do I do with it?" The mirror fogged and a single word appeared. "Basement." I descended into the building's basement, the key clutched tightly in my hand. Among the old storage units, I found one with a padlock that matched the key. My heart raced as I turned the lock and opened the door. Inside was a small, dusty room, filled with old furniture and boxes. In the corner, I found a stack of journals. They belonged to Henry, detailing his life and the events leading up to his death. He wrote about being tormented by a neighbor who wanted him out of the apartment. The final entry was a plea for help, dated the day before he died. I brought the journals to the police, who reopened the case. The neighbor was eventually arrested, and Henry's death was reclassified as a homicide. The restless spirit that had haunted my nights was finally at peace. The whispers stopped and my breath was fresh. With Henry's story told, I felt a sense of closure. My confidence returned and I began to rebuild my life. free from the shadow of bad breath and haunted mirrors. I stood in front of the bathroom mirror one last time, smiling at my reflection. "Thank you, Henry," I whispered. "Rest in peace." As I walked away, I glanced back. The mirror was clear, and for the first time in years, so was my mind.
The breeze at the beach was strong, with a liqueur of liberty that permeated the senses. I basked in the sunset, the sight of orange lines streaming along the edge of an endless horizon. The waves crashed softly to the bank in relentless flushing advance on sand. The sand resisted, cleaving and maneuvering from the way of water as it all poured back to reunite with the big sea. It was a curious spectacle to behold how freely the world interacted. I took long sniffs of the clean sea air to ease the path into my lungs. It was the first time I had had clean air in weeks. An hour ago, I could still envision the blue invisible trail of the city's carbon in the air. My chest had contracted at the instance of that horrible city that I sought escape from. The dull passage of time with monotonous urgency of activities in its company, all pressing towards nowhere. It riled my stomach and parched my mouth. I turned around in my small recliner and lay on my back. I lay on the beach and gazed up at the sky above. I let out a sigh of relief, feeling a sense of calm wash over me. The breeze of the sea continued from where I stopped, and my mouth watered in relish. I pressed my hands into my recliner, and it squeaked. My eyes drifted closer, and I entered into a world of induced pleasure. As I relaxed, my breath escaped, carrying away the stress of the past week. I held onto the fabric beneath me, feeling a sense of comfort. Suddenly, I sensed someone nearby, and I immediately stopped and opened my eyes. "Hi." The stranger's presence was unwavering. The smile on her face was easy to dismiss for the same reason that her aura was that stifling. Her face smiled, her cheeks spread apart, and her lips unclasped to reveal her teeth. But I was able to pick the insincerity. I didn't think it was necessary to smile back, so I didn't. "Can I help you?" I quizzed, stirring on my recliner without rising from my position. She balked and cocked her head slightly leftward. A dull pair of eyes, despite her best effort at evoking friendliness, betrayed her. She drew them close in contemplation. "You aren't alone here, aren't you?" she asked me. I hesitated to answer. I was a woman as much as she was, but it seemed odd to me that she would be so direct in her question. I slowly rose from my position to sit upright. "I don't think I should answer such a question. If you don't mind, I'd like to be left alone," I answered as softly as I could. My mind had already begun to race. I knew as soon as she left me alone, I would find my way to my car and soon be gone from the beach. Her nose turned up in disgust, and her eyes wandered around my body briefly. She looked straight in my eyes, and I looked in hers. Such beautiful blue eyes she had. She had dirty blonde hair that went past her shoulder with the fringes hanging around her neck. Her bikini was brown, and they suited the tan of her skin. I did not bother to stare more, suspecting I may give her ideas of desire, which I was unwilling to offer. I strategically looked away from her. "Jerry, I think we have a bit this one," she suddenly called out. The air on the beach suddenly ran cold against my skin. My heart stopped and my vision tunneled at her words. Sheer horror froze my limbs as I turned my neck to the sight of a man marching briskly towards us from my rear. My mind reeled as all else felt numb to my senses. "We'll dump her in the sea," she hollered at the man. My chest contracted again, and respiration became a difficult affair. The contraction was worse than it was in the city. It was no ordinary course of affairs. My life was flashing before my eyes, and I was tumbling through emotions I did not suspect I had. My lips hung loose, as did my thoughts. My hearing failed me, but her last words rang in my head as though it were my own thoughts. Time was not an ally as the man burst from a march into a jog. In my dizziness, I sprung to my feet. I lost grip on what was real and what was being imagined in the moment. The thoughts that occupied my head were unclear, and I knew I had little time to process them. I followed instinct. I swung my feet towards her stomach as hard as I could. The slap was so resounding that I felt my ankle move. Adrenaline washed over the ache, and I was too numb to feel anything. "Ow!" she cried, grabbing onto her stomach. My feet obliged me to run, and I did. "Come here, you little bitch." The one she had called Jerry hollered at me, but he was simply too far to enforce his order. I sensed it would take a good sprint for him to close the gap between us. My heart was beating so quickly that I almost tumbled over the heaps of beach sand. I said a small word of prayer, and tears drifted from my eyes as I ran in terror. It took all I had in me to protect my own life, and I was ready to expend it. "God, please," I begged, hoping to reach my car before they caught up with me. My salvation in this instance was a Glock I always left between the acceleration and brake pedals of my car. It was easy to reach, I knew, but I only needed to reach it. I felt his spittle sprinkle over my back as he grabbed a tuft of my hair. He finished his words. He had my held back and slammed my face against the door. I pulled my door open with the same motion. A piercing noise lined my ears, and I shook my head to get out of the pain. He was panting, I was panting, but I was on the floor beside my open door, and he took his eyes off me. "Keep up, Christy," he called out, and it broke through the buzz in my head. I opened my eyes, and in one final act of desperation, I leaped straight under my seat. "What the hell?" he cried in shock when he returned his attention to me and found the gun in my hand. Christy had already kept up and was within my range. I worked the gun with familiarity and pulled the trigger point blank on his chest. One shot and he was on the floor, clutching his chest as he struggled for breath. Christy spun around too late. I was too numb to think. I fired another shot and she was on the floor. "Oh God," I cried as I picked myself up off the floor and away from my horror. I turned the ignition on and the engine revved.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.
I drove away with two bodies on the floor, grateful for my life.